Perversely, on the after-movie diner. I'm sorry, that should read previously. Let's start that again. Previously on the after-movie diner, Nigel Balforceps, heir to the Chad Tillingbourne fortune of two highly polished golden Peruvian dogs and a few thousand barrels of an unknown greenish liquid that may or may not contain the secret to life itself, but is probably just a fruit extract for use in children's party food, has been forced to flee Pissbottington Hall due to the revelation of his affair with Gladys Uppington Ponsonby, who isn't much to look at, but who the locals down at the old Bull and Truncheon describe as a real firecracker, who after a few sacks of mead goes like a bloody rocket. That's a nude perky rocket, they clarified. This leaves the unruly, untrustworthy, sinister, and often overly salivating evil Uncle Rupert in legal charge of the Ginger Children, who, until they turn 18 and are officially presented with a safety plaque by the Queen herself, must be watched around the clock by a fleet of only partially clothed tap-dancing butlers and a matron named Goethe von Himmelstrasse, who once beat Goebbels nonsensical with a giant mouldy sausage. Meanwhile, in the neighbouring village of Clenchy Rectum, the questionable vicar, Tony Big Trumpets, town councillor, Freddie Plurfgumption, and baker, Herbie Tits, are frantically putting an overly complicated plan together to break wrongly convicted pigeon fancier and one-time winner of the Order of the Garter for an incident of indecent exposure which cost the Argentinians the Falkland Islands, Geraldine Nobody's business, out of a highly guarded outhouse, which is serving as a temporary prison while the other one is being painted and sprayed for quiche. If they don't succeed by midnight, then the deeds to the rectory divert back to oil magnate, playboy, large hat wearer, and occasional puncher of goats, Jack Chest, who intends to have it knocked down to build a large public walk-in wardrobe displaying his collection of highly decorative used merkins and an exhibition of just how many things he's managed to achieve in his life while naked from the waist down. And finally, retired game show host Lenny Cream has been found dead under a stack of defaced pamphlets entitled Premature Ejaculators Monthly. Cause of death is not yet known, but Inspector Hiccup of the Yard, the back wall and a small patch of land he won in a bet in Antigua, thinks that the large knife sticking out of his spine may have something to do with it. What will this mean for Justin, the bisexual midget fish farmer, crossdresser and game show prize display model prodigy who just moved here from Montreal? And where now for Lily Frung, one-time self-help book author, celebrity dietitian and sex with trampolines addict, who was revealed last week is back on a lethal cocktail of mescaline and tomato ketchup flavoured crisps, yet still planning to fly little Timmy Pip Omelette from Berlin to Reykjavik to be reunited with his long-lost real father so they can both sedate him in a motel bath and steal his genetically compatible bladder so that Timmy can have that life-saving surgery and go on to win the local ice baseball tournament for the $25,000 prize money, which will hopefully be enough to buy him a nice shiny sports car that'll open knickers quicker than Steven Seagal tears open a bag live ball for breakfast. Rubbers and rubberettes, and welcome to this week's lovely and pert episode of the Aftermovie Diner. Just a reminder, the next week is our first year anniversary and Evil Dead special episode. We've got lots of special guests and members of the cast even interviewed. We've also got some friends of mine joining us on the show to discuss all different aspects of the film, music and the special effects and their first time experience with the film and so on and so forth. It's going to be an absolutely amazingly special episode, and I urge you all to tune in for that. That'll be on July 23rd. And there's still time to write into aftermoviediner@gmail.com and tell us all of your Evil Dead stories. How did you first see it, your favourite scenes, etc. Also, stick around after today's movie chat and music for information on lots of other lovely podcasts you may enjoy. The podcast you're currently listening to is part of the Second Unit Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at 2upn.blogspot.com or on our Facebook under the Second Unit Podcast Network. Our fantastic list of shows include
Drunk on VHS,
We Came from the Basement,
The Aftermovie Diner,
Something Weird This Way Comes, with Rue and Mo,
No Budget Nightmares,
and Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentaries. The Second Unit Podcast Network, bringing you the action, leaving the boring stuff to the other guys. Oh my God, there's been a Lou Diamond Phillips pileup on the highway! All right, hello everybody again, and welcome to yet another episode of the Aftermovie Diner. I have with me in one of our hot pink leather booths, I don't know why they're hot pink, but they are for tonight, we have with us returning champion, Mr. Mosif Porn, who is joining us to discuss not one, but two 80s Bob Hoskins movies.
This is awesome.
Yes. How are you doing, sir?
Good. Good.
Excellent, excellent. And you raced through these two movies today, if I'm
not... Today, But it was good, though, because, you know, you had... I remember a long time ago, me and you had a discussion about British cinema, and there were some movies that I hadn't seen yet, and these were two of them.
Right.
You know, so it was a great excuse to actually sit down and watch them. So.
Well, the whole purpose of this particular episode is that there are, since living in the States, there have been a chunk of movies that we sort of grew up watching and just sort of took for granted in the UK that are known as some of the sort of best of UK movies that are just either unknown or little seen or Criterion Collection oddity type movies in the States. Sure. They're not so big. And, you know, even something like Get Carter, the Michael Caine movie in the UK, which is like...
Wait, isn't that a Stallone movie?
You're right, exactly. You see? but things like that, Ipcris Fire, like some of Michael Caine's biggest movies, and you think he's probably one of our biggest actors of all time, like one of our biggest exports. A lot of his early movies aren't known, and Bob Hoskins, who of course was known for Who Framed Roger Rabbit. These particular movies, I think, are certainly the best two he did from his early career. I know he came back later on and did some more indie spirited. British stuff much later on, but
it's kind of funny, after watching these movies, you know, because I was definitely not familiar with Bob Hoskins' like early career. I mean, I know he was an actor and I know he had done some good stuff, but I didn't realize how good.
Yeah,
you know, and it kind of dawned on me that really, like, I mean, I don't think I'm making too big of a stretch to say that Bob Hoskins is essentially the British Robert De Niro who just made some bad decisions.
Well, Robert De Niro has made some bad decisions, but yes.
No, but Robert De Niro waited. Robert De Niro waited until he was at that, like, you know, that like master thespian level before he started making career suicide moves. You know, Bob Hoskins did. I mean, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was great, so I can't give him. I'm not going to knock him on that. But then he did Super Mario Brothers.
Yes.
You know, which and De Niro's never done that.
No, well, he did Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Oh, yeah. Shit.
That's the comparison. But yeah, I mean, like, Tarantino speaks highly of Bob Hoskins. And I think a lot of people, when they saw Hoskins in American movies, didn't realize he was English because they think he does, like, a good Bronx-style accent. But yeah, I mean, he's... mixes up the movies in his... this is about 8 years into his career, the first movie we're covering tonight, which is The Long Good Friday. And before The Long Good Friday, it's a lot of TV stuff. Some of it very well-regarded TV stuff, especially things like Pennies from Heaven, which was later remade into an American movie, but was a TV series from a very famous British playwright, Dennis Potter. Who went on to do The Singing Detective and Lipstick on My Collar and a whole bunch of these. But so that was what he was sort of most famous for doing before The Long Good Friday, I would guess. And everything else is just sort of TV stuff. But yeah, let's do The Long Good Friday. Let's do the first thing. So it's a British gangster movie that would later sort of be, I'm going to say ripped off because I don't like him, by Guy Ritchie.
First, it was the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Now, it's the Long Good Friday. There was the courier, the cash, the ripoff, the boss, the meeting, the widow, the intrigue, the greed, the women, the secret, the setup, the murders. It started with betrayal and ended with revenge. One day, 36 hours of terror. The Long Good Friday.
Yeah,
The Long Good Friday, a gangster film in the classic old Hollywood mold of sharp craftsmanship. Bob Hoskins, a terrific actor, is a Cockney Edward G. Robinson. Jack Crow, Newsweek magazine. With The Long Good Friday, Bob Hoskins immediately joins the movie's most illustrious rogues gallery, a criminal roster that includes Edward G. Robinson's Little Caesar, James Cagney's Public Enemy, Rod Steiger's Al Capone, and Mickey Rooney's Babyface Nelson, Stephen Schaefer, Us Magazine. The Long Good Friday.
Talk us through the plot, dude, and talk us through what you felt watching it.
Well, I mean, yeah, like you said, it's a crime drama. You know, essentially we have Bob Hoskins playing a man named Harold, who is sort of like a kingpin type of, you know, he basically runs London. You know, he makes a bunch of, he doesn't make any mistakes at all, but his whole world starts crashing around him. And basically the entire movie is him trying to figure out what the fuck is going on.
Yeah, it's over Easter weekend in London. And basically the movie starts with Bob Hoskins returning from America, having spoken to some mafia guys with an idea of them teaming up and maybe semi going legit by putting their crook money into what is talked about as sort of an Olympic stadium, which is kind of ironic considering the Olympics is taking place.
Yeah, they were
in
saying
London,
they were saying they wanted to make an Olympic stadium so that they could have the 88 Olympics.
Right, yeah, and because he says, can you imagine, I think at one point in a quite politically incorrect scene, he says,
can you imagine Nick Nobbs doing the long jump along these keys? So he could rock it up their arsehole, he'll jump, all right.
Because it's basically back in London when the Docklands were, they hadn't been rebuilt and they hadn't been gentrified, I suppose, but, you know, it's all still run-down factories and cranes and things like that.
Yeah, there was no, you know, urban re-beautification projects yet, yeah.
And so what has happened while he's away in the States doing this deal, which is essentially going to legitimize both a faction of the mafia and a faction of the London Underground, members of his crew, specifically one particular member, has fucked up in Northern Ireland.
He
took some money he shouldn't have taken from a suitcase. Yeah. And this starts a series of events over
I think there was also a huge misunderstanding, too. I mean, obviously not the money being stolen. That's not a misunderstanding at all. But the money being stolen, and then I guess three of their top guys got knocked off, and they just kind of put two and two together and assumed that it was these guys.
Right. They blame the assassination of the IRA. Three of their top guys are knocked off at the same time that this happens, and they blame it all on Harold Shand. So they then, over the long Easter weekend, they come to London and things start happening. And the first thing that happens,
just start blowing shit up.
Right. And the first thing that happens is that his right hand man, is it Colin? Was his name the gay guy who's played by Paul Freeman, who people will know as Belloc from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's right.
Yes, Paul Freeman, Colin. Yeah, he comes back from Ireland and he is killed in a gay bathhouse, essentially, by
Pierce Brosnan.
A young Pierce Brosnan, yeah.
You know, I wanted to mention that because Pierce Brosnan, he's in this. It's his first movie role.
Right.
He doesn't have any spoken lines, but he's there, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I looked it up. He's 27 when this movie came out.
Yeah.
He looks 15. Like, he looks so ridiculously young. I mean, he's got, like, obviously he looks like he's gone through puberty. He's got the chest hair and whatever. But, I mean, but he looks so young. He's so baby-faced.
Yeah.
That it's kind of awesome to watch him, like, murder people because he looks like he should still be in primary school.
Yeah. And he kind of shows up and tries to make a play for Colin, but then, you know, double-crosses him and stabs him, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Americans fly into town, and just as the Americans fly into town, his mother's, Harold Shand's mother's limo, because his mother has got all religious in the end of her life, and this is a big bone of contention for the family. Mm-hmm. She's gone to Good Friday Mass, and her limousine and the limousine driver is blown up outside the church.
Which is very unfortunate, because that was a beautiful car.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very nice car. So they fly in just as Harold's sort of beginning to deal with this. And he of course, doesn't know anything at all about what's going on.
This is diabolical liberty.
What is it?
Blown up. He's dead.
Eric is dead. A car bomb.
Eh? I was all right. Suffering from shock. He's in the London hospital.
I don't understand.
You need a million-dollar computer to understand this. You do such a thing, it's outrageous. Outside a church? You don't go crucifying people outside a church, not on Good Friday.
What's the matter, Harold?
Eric's been blown up.
A bomb?
Yeah, in the rolls.
I don't believe it. When?
Just now. Mother's in hospital, suffering from shock. I'm not surprised. She went to church to say her prayers, not to get blown up.
But why?
Someone tried to discredit you in front of...
Well, the Yanks. No. Nobody knew, did they?
Well, they mustn't find out.
Now they're sleeping.
Right. I want everybody in the corporation working on this fast. Right? And I want Colin here. Where is he? He should have been here. Where is he?
He went swimming.
Swimming? He should have been here.
He doesn't know what's going on through most of the movie.
Right, it's not till the end.
It's quite literally the last, I'd say, 10 minutes of the movie he actually knows what's going on.
Yeah, when all is revealed to be someone within his mitts.
I actually thought that was a great way to tell the story. I mean, the fact that you're looking at the situation through Harold's eyes, essentially, and Harold has no idea what's going on, so... Really, you have no idea what's going on.
Right.
And all you know is that there's a couple of guys who are, like, blowing shit up and killing people, and you know that they're Irish.
Yeah.
But you don't know why they're pissed at it.
Because you don't know... like, those opening scenes... It wasn't until about the third or fourth time I'd seen it, but the opening scenes, which sort of give you a small montage about what goes on in Northern Ireland before Harold comes back on the plane and that amazing soundtrack kicks in as he's walking along the train station at the beginning... Yeah, you don't really get a full sense. You see the guys assassinated in, like, that old house in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And you see Colin take the money out of the suitcase, but you don't really know you don't really know if it's his money to take or not. It's all sort of a bit questionable. You see Kevin McNally, who is I don't know if he is actually gay or whether he just pretends to be in order to get Colin on his side in the bar. He would go on to be in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies many, many years later as a much fatter, older man.
And to think in this one, he's called the Irish Youth.
Yeah, he's just called
the Irish
Youth.
The character doesn't have a name, he's just Irish Youth.
Yeah, but the best thing I love about this movie is, Bob Hoskins' central performance. Secondly, the way London looks, because it just doesn't look like that anymore.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. You know, it's like I feel that Londoners and people from my area, you know, I mean, obviously where you are now, kind of have that sort of common bond where you guys used to have that old-timey London where it was like scummy, you know what I mean? And like, I don't want to use the term scummy, but unpolished. How about that?
Yeah.
You know? And New York obviously has a very long history of being unpolished as well. And both of them actually kind of cleaned up around the same time, too. And it's just like, it's very unfortunate because there's no, like, you know, there's no scum anymore.
The best way to put it, in a nicer way to put it, is that London used to... Okay, sorry. But London used to be a lot more working class, I think.
Sure, sure.
And what always happens with these cities is that the money floods outwards from the middle. So the money at the same time, you know, just as parts of Brooklyn and parts of the Bronx and parts of Queens are becoming more and more gentrified slowly as the years go on.
Yeah.
So if you go further south or if you go further north in London, where it was a lot more violent or working class or whatever, or factories and stuff back in the day, you know, now it's all students who have become like business students who have gone on to run their own companies and start up, you know, internet startup companies and things like that. And now they all have all the old houses are all been, you know, polished and painted.
Mm.
But so I love seeing old London. I love the soundtrack. I love Bob Hoskins' central performance.
That soundtrack kicked me in the teeth.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, because it's one of the first things you see or hear, really. You know, like the title comes on and that soundtrack kicks in and, you know, and it's like this wave hits over you. Like, you feel like you're in those Maxell commercials where, you know, like you're being like bombarded by sound, you know, because it's really, I mean, it's like, I mean, I said this on Facebook, but I mean, like, it's, you know, you, it gets your blood pumping, you know, like you get really excited to watch the movie you're about to watch.
I think that what's interesting about this as well is I think it stands shoulder to shoulder with any of the American 70s bleak crime films. And actually, when this goes up, last week we spoke about The Friends of Eddie Coyle, which is a sort of very bleak, slightly slow-moving crime drama in a similar vein where you have a central character who's trying to control everything for his benefit and eventually it all falls apart. So it's a sort of similar type storyline, only obviously different elements. And I think this stands shoulder to shoulder with any of them. I mean, it's, you know, it doesn't quite have the flair of something like a Scorsese or something like a Peckinpah or something like that. It doesn't quite have that.
But that wouldn't work.
Visual flair. No,
that wouldn't work for this at all. I mean, I would go so far as to say this is as fairly close to a perfect crime drama as you could get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's really like the way it's set up, the way it's filmed, you know, the obviously the score, the acting is fantastic, and the storyline, which obviously is the most important thing when you're dealing with like crime dramas, you know, it's really well done. I mean, if this movie had any more polish to it, it wouldn't work.
Right, and it's sort of Shakespearean in its setup as well. I mean, not to give it way too much credit, but yeah, it's kind of got that idea that sort of everyone, you know, all 12 men behind him kind of thing are against him. It's got that Julius Caesar or whatever. I like the nice little touches where, because you've got a crime boss trying to go legit, well, questionably legit, or certainly become more capitalist, which is the Western form of legit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you kind of side with him a bit about that. But obviously, you have those scenes where he goes to talk to one of his snitches, a drug peddling guy. In one of the slums or one of the slightly more run-down, grotty areas in London.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the scene where he rafts them out of bed, he's naked, and he gets his henchman to kind of cut him with a very large knife across the buttocks. And of course, as he's driving away, Bob Hoskins kind of looks out of the window and he's sort of, this used to be a nice street full of nice families, you know.
There's definitely an undercurrent of, you know, racism throughout the entire film.
Right, but it's more the fact that, and this is why I wanted to speak to an American about it, and I'll ask you the questions in a minute, but it's more the fact that in order to side with this guy, we're given the idea that he has a little bit of pride. He has a little bit of desire to see things a bit better. He has, you know, he wants to help his family out. He very much loves Helen Mirren, who he's with, his kind of gangster's mole who he's with. And although he's a violent man, he's an honorable man. You know what I mean? And even at the end, where he completely loses it, you see how distraught he is on his face. Not so much that he's done something violent, but that he's lost his composure and that he's lost his honor and that he's lost his calm.
So, well, there's a lot of situations in the movie where, you know, like, obviously he seems like there's a lot of situations where he doesn't want to actually get his own hands dirty, so to speak.
Oh, completely.
So I think in that particular scene that you're talking about, which, might I add, is one of the most brutal things I think I've ever seen on film.
Yeah, well, that's saying something coming from you, considering some of the films you've seen.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, we should probably say what happens, I would imagine.
We can build up
to
it.
He basically, he finds out, this is the scene where he finds out what had happened. And, and the, I can't remember what the character was who...
The character's name is Jeff, and it's played by Derek Thompson, who became very famous later on in England for playing a kind of vaguely benevolent character in a soap opera called Casualty, which was sort of the British version of ER, only less exciting and filmed in a studio with wobbly sets and that kind of thing.
So he finds out, and he finds out that basically the entirety of it is his fault, you know, is Jeff's fault, because he's the one who put Colin on it. And because
Jeff's
of that,
also trying to make,
you
know, deals behind his back and
exactly, you know,
screw
and,
him over.
And of course with the IRA, and he's the one who put Colin on the deal in the first place. So he's the reason why, you know, the money got stolen and why you know, accusations were made and blah blah blah.
Because Colin was never an operator. Colin was just an old friend that Bob Hoskins kind of kept around. You know, and would occasionally drive. He was just kind of one of his entourage. He was never meant to be like a, you know, a bag man or anything.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they make it very clear that it's an inappropriate. He was an inappropriate choice. And then he smashes a bottle over his head and stabs him in the neck a bunch of times.
Yes, right, exactly. Yeah, that's the brutal bit you're talking about. Is that he, you know, executes him with a broken liquor bottle.
Yeah.
In quite a graphic.
Very graphic. It's actually one of the very few times where, because this is something you see in low budget films a lot, where they'll have instead of shooting the person being stabbed, they'll shoot towards the person who's doing the stabbing, and they're just kind of like lunging with the knife, you know.
Yeah.
And they do that with this, you know, and Harold is lunging at him with the bottle, but it actually looks like realistic, as opposed to a lot of low budget films that don't look realistic at all.
As opposed to a guy lying off screen squirting ketchup in his face.
Exactly. Yeah. And then of course with this one, when you finally do see the carnage, you know, there's blood squirting from his neck, and it's just like, shit.
It's kind of cool. And there are some so I was going to ask, as an American, do you get that whole sense? Because one of the things that's sort of boiling under any British crime story, especially anyone set in London, it just in that way, well, almost in an even bigger way than the mafia and their sense of family.
Mm-hmm.
British crime people, both in reality and in the movies, because there was a very famous British pair of brothers, the Cray brothers, who sort of ran London for quite a long time, ran the criminal element in London. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the joke about them was, they didn't half love their mum. Like, there was this whole thing where British pride and pride in the family and pride in Britain and pride in London and pride, it was all to do with, you know, God Save the Queen and Fly the Flag and all this sort of stuff. And it was all this sort of honesty born out of patriotism and pride and so on and so forth. And I wondered if, like, that translates in this movie as to part of his intention, like part of his plan in going straight and part of his plan in sort of regentrifying parts of London.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I'm necessarily the best person to ask that. I mean, I'm a bit of an Anglophile, so I mean, I get it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I see it. I don't know if the average American would.
Right. I don't know any average American.
I mean, or even for that matter, I don't even know if the average American film fan would even get that.
Right. Okay.
But I get it.
Okay. Well, you go then. I'll go find an average American. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But
I know a couple. I'll get you their numbers.
Yeah, we'll find out what Bosch thinks of it, I guess. But
that's average.
Well, no, he isn't, is he? I don't know any average Americans. You're all nutters.
It's true. It is true.
But okay, so key scenes, fun bits. What were your like favorite bits?
There were a couple. I really enjoyed P.H. Moriarty as Razors.
Yeah, who again crops up in the? Doesn't he crop up in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking
Barrels?
Yeah,
he plays Hatchet Harry in Lock, Stock, sure. and he was actually in. He's actually in this other movie I own called Slayground.
Right,
that's really good. The music, obviously, there's some really great lines. Like there's a moment where they're kind of talking at the beginning, and Victoria corrects Harold. He was saying something about playing hockey, and she's like, "No, lacrosse."
Yeah,
you know, because hockey is too vulgar.
Yeah,
and he says, "Yeah, the Yanks really like it when they arrive. Really feel like they have arrived in England when the upper crust treats them like shit."
Yeah, right.
Maybe we should have gone to the airport to meet him.
No, play it cool. When a governor of Coca-Cola drops into London, the Queen don't go dashing off to Heathrow, does she?
Queen?
Yeah, well, you know what I mean. all played it up, right? You went to school with Princess Anne, played hockey with her, all that.
It's lacrosse at Benenden. Hockey's frightfully vulgar.
Yeah, yeah, plenty of that. The Yanks love snobbery. They really feel they've arrived in England if the upper classes treat them like shit.
Gives them a sense of history.
Yeah.
We'd better check how the chef's progressing.
Here, that frog don't half know about crap. The smells have been coming up from the galley all morning and been driving me potty.
There's a whole bit, isn't there, on the boat at the beginning where he's talking about, yeah, real tough it up a bit, you know, real...
Yeah,
right. Because he lays on there, he's got this sort of big... What are they called, those big boats? Just like a big sort of posh yacht thing.
Yeah, that, yeah.
Holds a big party on, and they sail it down the Thames. And
let's see, what else? The scene in the elevator, you know what I'm talking about?
I was just going to bring that up, where Jeff says there's two bits of this movie that are borderline sort of laugh out loud comical, although they're not meant to be. And one is this line, and what does he say to Helen Mirren?
He goes, "I want to lick every inch of you."
And I wonder how many times some guy has wandered up to Helen Mirren and looked her straight in the eyes, you know, on the street, and said it to her.
Are you kidding me? If I met Helen Mirren now, I would say it to her.
Oh, fuck
Helen, yeah. Helen Mirren is the only actress I can think of, with the exception of maybe Anne Margaret,
okay,
you know, who still looks so damn good now that I'd be like, I want to lick that, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
But actually, like, the whole scene is kind of crazy too, because like there's like he hits the button and the elevator doesn't go, and like there's this almost kind of like little sense of dread.
Yes,
you know, and like she's gonna hit that button, you know, and you're like, the thing's gonna just fucking explode,
right?
You know, and then she hits the button and it just moves.
Yeah. I'd never thought of it like that before. Do you know, I've watched this movie 100 times. I'd never thought that when they got in the elevator, there was a sense that it could blow up. That's a really cool take on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what it seemed like to me. I mean, like, they're you know,
sure,
they're,
of course,
they're blowing shit up. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
And then the scene where they finally, quote unquote, get their revenge on the Irish, and they shoot the guys up in that room and they fall onto the track. And there's that, like, just in spectacular car crash scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about the other famous scene from it is the scene where they go out and they round up all the snitches in town and
they
hang
have everybody
them
hanging from meat hooks.
Yeah, hang them upside down from meat hooks in a big meat factory, that's one of the coolest scenes, I think.
For more than 10 years there's been peace. Everyone to his own patch. We've all had it sweet. I've done every single one of you favours in the past. I've put money in all your pockets. I've treated you lot well, even when you was out of order, right? Well, now there's been an eruption. It's like fucking Belfast on a bad night. One of my closest friends, he's lying out there in the freezer. And believe me, all of you, nobody goes home until I find out who done it and why.
Harold, believe me, look, if I knew, I'd say. Look, the last thing I want is any trouble. Everything's going too well for us.
You lying bastard.
Am I? Look, things have never been so good between South London and the East End.
You bastard.
Ooh, all
you
right,
lying Jeff. Bastard, of course it is.
No, all right, Alan.
You lying bastard. Fuck,
you lying bastard.
Oi, Jeff, you behave yourself.
If you kill him, we got gang war in our heads, right?
We already have. They're walking all over you. That's because we ain't got no lead. Ah, Parky, about time. Well?
You've got to drop it, Harold. It's not that lot. I've had the bomb checked.
And?
It's the same sort of device the IRA use. This is a special branch now, Harold. I'm turning it over to them.
What the Irish got to do with me? It's just a bunch of woods trying to muscle in.
For Christ's sake, Harold, they're not just gangsters. They run half of Londonderry on terror. Could be London next.
Oh, no. I run London.
Not now, Harold. They're taking it away from you. It's special branch now. and I'm getting out.
Remember who pays your wages, Parker. You ain't going nowhere. Now, tell me something worthwhile.
There was a robbery at Councillor Harris's demolition yard. Explosives. We pulled in the security guard, Flynn. We grilled him for hours, but he just wouldn't crack. He was too scared.
Alan, check out this geezer, Flynn. Bring him in.
Harold, you can't do that!
Don't you ever tell me what I can or can't do. Bent law can be tolerated for as long as they're lubricating, but you have become definitely parched. If I was you, I'd run for cover and close the hatch, because you're going to wind up on one of those meat hooks, my son.
That's some real amazing, like, you know, symbolism there, or imagery, I should say.
Yeah.
You know, just the fact that this guy has enough clout that he can go out in, like, because they did that in 2 hours.
Yes.
You know, he's like, meet me in 2 hours at, you know,
yeah,
and an abattoir.
Like, take all the shooters, because they're not guns. Take all the shooters, and they've got to like they've all got to pick up their own little.
Yeah, Harold doesn't call anything by its real name.
No, well, he's a Londoner.
I guess so. Because, like, any time he told somebody to use the phone for some reason, it was always something else. It was like, you know, hop on the trumpet, get on the blower. You know, it was always, never phone.
Get on the blower, the trumpet, the dog. Yeah, whatever it is. I know you hate Cockney rhyming slang, so I won't
go into that.
How did you feel as an American that last, well, the penultimate scene of the movie where he basically tears the two mafia guys down in their own hotel room?
It was like ecstasy. That was like it was such a great line.
For sure. Everything's all right. All the troubles are over.
What did he say? Sorry, Hal, but I'm glad you dropped in to say goodbye. That's real nice.
We leaving?
Yeah.
We're not going back to New York.
Next flight out.
Hey, come on, Charlie. I know we've had a few problems. We've only been here a couple of days.
Yeah, a couple of days that turned out to be another St. Valentine's massacre.
But that settled it. Once and for all.
Yes, I'd like a porter to suite 513, please, and we'd like a cab right away. Thank you.
You two can't wait to get out of here, can you?
I always react like that to bombs blowing up, mass murders. It's a hang-up of mine.
It's coming to something when the mafia can't handle a little problem, isn't it?
A little problem? Tony, did you hear what he said? A little problem. Harold, this is like a bad night in Vietnam.
But it's over. I've pulled the plug on them.
We do not deal with gangsters, period. This country's a worse risk than Cuba was. It's a banana republic. You're a mess.
Ciao, Harold.
Bon voyage. I'll tell you something. I'm glad I found out in time just what a partnership with a pair of wankers like you would have been. A sleeping partner's one thing, but you're in a fucking coma. No wonder you've got an energy crisis your side of the water. But us British, we used to have a bit more vitality, imagination, touch of the Dunkirk spirit, know what I mean? The days when Yanks could come over here and buy up Nelson's Column and an Harley Street surgeon and a couple of windmill girls are definitely over.
Now look.
Shut up, you long streak of paralyzed piss. What I'm looking for is someone who can contribute to what England has given to the world. Culture, sophistication, genius. A little bit more than an hot dog. Know what I mean? We're in the common market now. And my new deal is with Europe. I'm going into partnership with a German organization. Yeah, the Krauts. They've got ambition, know-how. And they don't lose their bottle. Look at you. The mafia. I've shit him.
Because, you know, really, I mean, I don't want to say anything that's going to insult the mafia, but, you know, I mean, really, it's just the whole, like, Cosa Nostra family bullshit. It's really just kind of stupid, you know? It's like, there's no, like, I don't get it. maybe that's just the thing for me. I just don't get it.
Right.
Like I definitely understand and have a better appreciation for, you know, for British gangsters than American. But you know, but when he, you know, yeah, when he tears into them at the end and you know, I mean, and he does it with just such panache, you know.
Bit the Dunkirk spirit, he says, and then he goes, "Mafia, I shit 'em," which is possibly the best fucking line Bob Hoskins has ever said anywhere.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's a true, without wanting to sound pretentious, it is a real tour de force performance from him.
Sure.
And it's fantastic. And I won't spoil the ultimate ending, but there is one other scene after that, which is possibly one of the best endings to a movie ever.
I, you know, it's funny. I didn't even think that we wouldn't talk about it because
right.
I literally wrote like a paragraph and a half.
Fine.
Of
then let's,
notes
then
just
let's...
about. No, it's okay. I mean, basically, what we'll say is, I mean, I want people to go out and watch this.
Yes.
You know, so like this isn't No Budget Nightmares. Like, go out and actually watch this movie. But just, you know, like because the ending doesn't feel like the ending.
No.
You know, until the credits start rolling, and then once you realize that was the end of the movie, you're like, shit, what a perfect way to end the film.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, yeah, have people go out, you know, and just and think about it.
Definitely.
Like, especially as the credits are rolling, think about that last scene and how powerful it was with him doing nothing.
Yeah. Completely. And
yeah.
It's been mirrored in there's two other movies I can think of. In fact, recent movies that have come out in America in like the last 10 years that have done similar things with the end of their movies. But just to touch on a bit from what you were saying about the difference between American and British gangster stories, or certainly this one, because I can't say when Ritchie sort of dug up the genre and did all those like Snatch and Lock, yeah. Stock and all those, you know, I had only recently, probably within the last 4 or 5 years of that, of Lock, Stock coming out, I had only recently kind of got into these early 80s ones. So for me, I was on my snooty teenage high horse and I was like, fuck Richie redoing it. I know the real ones, you know, fuck him. So I never sort of went and watched those to some extent. I'm not a big fan of him anyway, but the difference.
I like those movies for what they are.
Sure.
I don't really like, I never really think of them as, cause they're like, they're not like gangster movies in my mind. They're
right.
Like, you know, a bunch of like hoods.
Sure.
You know?
But no, my point was going to be was, whereas if you look at Goodfellas or you look at Casino or you look at some of those Scorsese ones,
mm-hmm.
and even Mean Streets to some extent,
sure,
the failure, the thing that sort of screws them up, the thing that then you know, breaks apart the criminal organization is normally ego, stupidity, pride. You know, it's normally Joe Pesci who's like, fuck it, I'm going to make stupid decisions, but then I'm going to kill you if you even look at me wrong, even though I just made a really blundering, stupid fucking decision.
And he actually made an entire career out of doing that.
Right, exactly. It's normally this egotistical arrogance within those characters in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, although, like, or you know, Harold Shand is undoubtedly full of pride and ego and all those things. The interesting thing about the British gangster movie versus that one is it's more that the mistakes that are made, while they are stupid or whatever, there's certain thought behind it and there's certain motivation behind it, and it's not just we're going to have a stupid, you know, pig-headed character who's going to fuck this all up for us.
Yeah.
You know, Jeff wants something out of the deal. Like, Jeff wants to work with the Irish, fuck working with the Yanks, work with the Irish, because he sees the IRA as going to be the next big thing, which of course they never were. And, you know, Paul Freeman's character, Colin, wrong place, wrong time, does something because he's got emotional and psychological problems and, you know, takes the money and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a bunch of pig-headed idiots.
But you just kind of described the mafia in a nutshell right there.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of pig-headed idiots.
Well, you said that, not me.
But I said it on your show.
The After Movie Diner does not endorse. No, I'm kidding. But so I don't
you
know whether...
You know, I'm sorry to cut you off. You know,
sorry, no.
Me and Doug were talking about something yesterday, and Doug actually did the same thing to me. He's like, No Budget Nightmares does not endorse the views of Mel Porn.
Which is great, because as long as we can get that on as many podcasts that you're involved in as possible, that's what we want. So, I mean, I don't know whether I'm sort of elevating it too much, but it feels to me like there's more, the characters have more thought and motivation than just, you know, don't look at me funny or I'm going to shoot you in the face kind of thing.
Well, it's not necessarily even the characters. I mean, it's the inspiration has more thought and motivation than anything that, you know, that the Americans have to work with. So, I mean, it makes sense that it would be different.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm glad that came across for you as well. And I also like the idea of covering this movie with an American, because it's about like two Americans coming to London and then
being shit on.
Well, no, but also like neither the Brit nor the American can kind of fully understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's my podcast in a nutshell. But I mean, was there anything more you wanted to say about sort of the design of the movie or the? I mean, it feels real to me. I don't know why. There are certain stylized moments. The other laugh out loud moment I was going to say was, what about that shower scene with Hoskins? It's a little too much, isn't it?
It goes on for a little too long, and if that was just like a window or like a shower door that they were shooting through that was creating that weird effect on the lens, but that it went on for a little too long, and basically it was just like, you know, like what were we supposed to be like? Ooh, you know,
right?
Look at Bob Hoskins.
Well,
you know?
It's meant to be. He's just done this big thing that has taken such. It's meant to be like the day, the emotional toil of the day.
Sure. Yeah. It's all washing away.
He's trying to wash it off and it's not succeeding. Like,
yeah.
My problem with that is that is a metaphor that has been used a bazillion times.
Sure.
And the last thing. They even had it in the first Craig Bond movie, like him and fucking Eva Green sat in a shower while and I was just thinking, really? James Bond has a moment where he has to sit in the shower and weep like a pussy? Like, what's going on there? And to me, I understand why it's in there, but I agree it goes on way too fucking long. And did you find at any point that they're constantly having to make ridiculous excuses to the Americans for why shit was blowing up?
I loved that.
Right, but it borders slightly on farcical, doesn't it?
Sure, yeah. I mean, granted, they only really had to explain, you know, two explosions, but, you know, still, I mean, the fact that you have to explain two explosions in the same day is ridiculous.
And the American is like, gee, you should get your natural gas problem sorted, or whatever he says.
Well, what was it? There's the scene at the diner where, or at the restaurant, I guess I should say, where she goes to light a cigarette. He's like, I don't know, do you think you should do that with your natural gas
problems?
Oh,
that's it. Yeah, right. They're right. And that's an excellent scene where she has to hold her own. She's left alone to kind of woo these two mafia guys.
She's got that city council guy or whatever you would call him.
Right.
The council guy is getting, public servant who is basically, he's spending all of his attention hitting on her.
Right. Well, you've got Jeff, who's, we already know, is kind of a bit of a creep. You've got the councilman getting drunk and shooting his mouth off.
Yeah.
You've got Helen Mirren desperately trying to keep it together. And you've got the two mafia guys who, the moment they're alone with Helen Mirren, basically turn around and say, look, we know shit's going down and we know it isn't what you're saying. You've got 24 hours to get your house in order or we're off. Fuck you. You know, and it's a really great scene. Anyway, we should, because of time, move on to Bob Hoskins. Well, I think the other great movie of his career, in my opinion, Mona Lisa, which is from 1985. So
just real quick, I just happened to be on IMDb and I noticed one of the user reviews is a long damn good film.
Oh, very cool. That's a very cool that's a very cool review. And did you want it like points out of 5 for the Long Good Friday, sir?
5.
Excellent. And did you have anything in your notes that we didn't touch on that you can touch on?
No.
Excellent. Okay, so we'll move on to Mona Lisa, which is sort of a bit more of a complicated emotional drama, although it does take place within the even seedier underbelly of London.
Really does, yeah.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile.
She is mysterious, unattainable. He is decent, ordinary.
The business is different, but the roles are still the same.
Dependent upon each other.
Go look at her best.
You should know these little things. The little things.
They are different. In every way.
Did anybody ever teach you manners?
Do you want to work for me?
No!
That's all me, I'm fired.
All right, the fans love me. I'm fired and you're street walking.
A woman.
It's nothing.
And a man.
Yeah. It's lovely.
Looking for something.
They're so young. Things can happen out there. If you last a year and a half on that street, you're looking. I was looking. I ran out.
Looking for someone.
I can't go down. But you could.
You? What'd you do?
Drive! George!
Tell us of words, you can cut your face
off. Drive! What'd you?
You don't need anybody, do you?
I do. I need you.
Better.
Well, what do you mean, better?
Tommy, dirty, nasty, slimy, kicking. Simone, get out! You gotta get out!
George! George!
Simone!
Bob Hoskins, Kathy Tyson, Michael Caine, Mona Lisa. Sometimes love is a strange and wicked game.
But it's kind of funny when you look at these two movies and the difference between them, because I mean, really, because Mona Lisa was done in 82.
No, it comes out 86.
80. Oh, where did I get 82 from? Never mind then. The point I was going to make is pointless.
No. Oh, okay. No, Mona Lisa is drenched in the mid-80s neon.
Well, that's what I was
going
to say, because I thought it was kind of amazing that you get this movie that comes out in 80, and for some reason I thought the other one came out in 82, and just how different they look, you know? I'm wrong.
No, exactly. You are wrong, Mo, and I want to take this moment to acknowledge it. No, okay. oddly enough, the history behind The Long Good Friday, I mean, The Long Good Friday takes place at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, I suppose, just before Thatcher and Reagan really kind of get hold of both our nations and strangle them into a kind of capitalist nightmare. Not that I'm, you know, necessarily a communist, but they did go way too overboard. You know, and Thatcher started a war she didn't need to start.
Communist, socialist, you know, Marxist, Republican, Democrat, whatever. You know, the fact still remains is that those particular people got a hold of our particular countries and ruined them.
Yes, they did. We move forward sort of 6 years in London's history, and London is in the throes of wrestling with this sort of influx of money while the seedy crime shit is still going on underneath, and we get Mona Lisa, which is a story. Did you want to describe this one, or should I go ahead again, dude?
You can do this one.
Okay. Basically, Bob Hoskins plays someone much further down on the totem pole in this. In fact, one of the lowest guys on the totem pole in a crime syndicate type thing. Not that we ever kind of find out too much about the crime syndicate. It's only really seen at the beginning. And he is given a job driving a hooker around. And while, you know, she hates him, and they have a kind of back and forth for a while, because she's not so much a hooker, she's more of like an escort. But
yeah, she's like, I mean, I don't want to, you know, they give you the impression that she's a high-priced call girl, and then you kind of see her, you know, in action, you realize, yeah, she's kind of just more of like, you know, one or two steps off the street, you know.
Right, exactly.
But she's good enough that she doesn't have to walk the street.
And she's a tall black tar, as he calls her. Which is great. And he...
A tall, thin, black tart.
Yeah, tall, thin, black tart. Too many T's. But He lives or hangs out with his kind of eccentric buddy, who's played by Robbie Coltrane.
Who has the greatest hair in this movie that I've ever seen.
Well, he's got like 50 greaser kind of pompadour thing going on. Slightly,
it's really ridiculous. Yeah.
And this was back when Coltrane was known mainly as a comedic actor in the UK. He had done a lot of appearances in a series called the Comic Strip, which was made up of a lot of alternative comedians doing half an hour to 45 minute comedic dramas. And he had sort of shown up in them. So he is very much the comic relief of this movie. And then you've got the other main character, and he's a very low level guy who kind of sells or houses. I don't know whether he actually goes out and sells junk on the street, like a street vendor, or whether he just houses it.
Yeah, I didn't quite get that myself. I'm like, he seemed like he was either a collector and seller of items, or that he was a distributor of items. But it also seemed like he was a bit of an inventor and created things with those items.
What do you think?
What do you do, melt it down and eat it?
No, they're ornamental, George.
Ornamental spaghetti?
Aye. I reckon it'll go a bomb.
Where'd you get it?
Contacts, George. Can't find plastic spaghetti just anywhere.
Huh. I don't suppose too many people make it, do they?
Aye, well, the Japanese have cornered the market. You fancy a fiberglass fruit flan? Or a polystyrene tutti frutti? Fancy a cup of tea?
What's it made of? Leaves!
I don't know. I wanted to ask you, did that stuff sort of come across? I mean, because I don't know that that junk necessarily exists anymore, but there was a certain time where you could buy, like, fake plastic eggs as if it was, like, a joke item or something.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we saw it for a little while. I don't know how big it ever got here. I think the biggest we ever had was, like, wax fruit and stuff like that. But, I mean, yeah, the plastic kind of stuff, not as much. Not outside of, like, kids' toys.
Right, exactly. And, then, you know, you could buy, like, a ketchup bottle pouring ketchup out onto a table that stood on the plastic. Yeah, it's all that kind of junk that you would see. If you went round the street markets in London, which were prevalent at the time, you would see this kind of junk being sold. So maybe he just houses them, creates them, whatever he does. But he's a sort of very fun character in the movie.
And yeah, they have a really funny sort of back and forth at the beginning where his name's Thomas offers him a cup of tea and George goes, "What's it made out of?"
Exactly. They have this kind of fun back and forth, which lightens the mood because the rest of the movie spends a lot of time in the gutter.
Oh, it's so like I mean, I know we described the last movie as bleak, but I mean, I think it's also a great way to describe this one.
Yes, definitely.
There's a lot of darkness and sadness.
Yeah.
And and haunting imagery.
Well, it's directed by Neil Jordan, who would be...
Which says a lot.
Right. And he, you know, he's a very famous Irish director who, you know, I think probably the closest to something like this in sort of grubby, greasy tone is something like The Crying Game, which the joke about The Crying Game is that the prostitute in Mona Lisa is played by Kathy Tyson, a very famous, well-known actress. And it's the interesting thing about it is she's in a couple of things that Neil Jordan did early in his career, most famously Mona Lisa. And what's interesting about when you get to The Crying Game is that in The Crying Game, obviously you have this tall, thin actor who looks like an actress throughout two-thirds of the movie, obviously, before her cock is revealed. And, you know, the interesting thing about it is he is made to look like Kathy Tyson in that movie as much as possible, and it's sort of very odd. Anyway, and then the other character in it is Michael Caine, who is... We're never sure if he's, like, the big, big boss, but he's certainly higher up there in the underworld, and he sort of gives George his marching orders and kind of harasses
I never got the impression that he was the boss.
No.
I got the impression that he was like a what's the term would be like a lieutenant or like a general, I don't know gang terms, but like he controlled an area.
Sure.
And it was but he was definitely George's superior.
Right.
Hi, George.
How are you doing?
How's the missus?
don't see her, did he?
Ah, the kid did.
Yeah, she's fine.
It's my birthday today. Yeah? Do you know that? My fucking birthday.
Mm. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much, George. Brilliant.
Just one more, I want to do it again, eh? Okay, stand by, everybody. One.
Aren't you going to ask me what age?
What age are you?
52, George. Five, six, and you?
That's not my birthday, is it?
No, it's not your birthday, is it? You know what I think?
What do you think?
I think that you think I left you in the shit.
Well, you did, didn't you? Kind of.
Have a drink anyway, George. Life goes on happening. We can't control it. We can only swim in it.
So what happens when you can't swim?
You get water on the brain, George.
But that can't be good, Denny.
And do you know what happens then, George?
What happens?
You get confused, and always with the little things. You know the little things.
What little things?
Do you or do you not get confused?
Yeah, I'll get confused.
You still get confused?
Yes, I get confused.
Great, great. Well, at least now you know. You do know it, don't you, George?
All right, now I know.
Well, that's something.
Hey?
Because do you know what I'm good at, George?
What?
I'm good at the little things. The little things that mean everything. The things that you forget, George. I've got a family of my own now, and it's all perfectly legal, and it's all through the little things. And you're part of that family, George. One of my favourite parts.
I'm glad, Denny.
I'm happy that you're glad, George. Want another drink?
No. So, what's it all about? What am I doing here?
You're being happy, that's what it's all about. You come out, I wasn't here. Now I'm here. I want you to know that I know that.
Well, I know.
That girl sees the arrow.
Every night.
You ask her what she does.
What do you mean, what she does?
I mean, what she does, what he pays her for.
Well, why me?
Because you drive her, George. You should notice these things. The little things. The business is different, but the rules are still the same. I mean, I can't ask her that. She tells you, truthfully, mind, that's important. You tell me, and I'll be happy, George. You didn't like me, did you?
Well,
don't worry. Everyone hates me once in a while. But it's important to me, George, that you're happy.
Well, I'm happy.
Good. And there's a lot of this in, like, British TV and movies where, you know, because Michael Caine, like, none of them are making enough money to really, like, dress well. And so, in fact, the hooker makes more money than any of them. And, you know, Michael Caine dresses like this kind of, see, we would call it kind of spivvy sort of, you know, he's wearing, like, low-rent slacks and plastic shoes and, you know, a shitty coat and stuff. Like, and it's all about, it's all to do with when crime in London went from being about guns and taking over territory and, you know, robberies and things like that to becoming about porn and becoming about prostitution and becoming about this very sort of seedy series of knocking shops and brothels and things. And you see some of those, I mean, that still exists, that red light district that you see mm-hmm. him walking through in London, that area, Soho, still exists. It's just, it's become, you know, it's just off Oxford Street, which is funny because it's where all Americans go to do their Christmas shopping. And if you step one block in any direction,
well, if I ever go to do my Christmas shopping there, I'll visit that section.
Sure, yeah, two blocks down the road, you can pick up lots of pornographic films and
happy birthday to me,
sex aids and stuff, right? And she, I mean, I suppose the last big character is the actor Clark Peters, who plays a really brutal, unpleasant pimp in the movie.
Oh, Anderson.
Anderson, yeah. And so slowly, sort of Hoskins and Tyson, their relationship grows to the point where she entrusts him with a knowledge about as someone she used to work with, a girl that she's missing, and B, trusts him to go find the girl.
Yeah, so you sort of have two stories kind of going parallel to each other. The story of her and her work and the story of him trying to track down this other girl.
Right.
Or I should really say the story of him trying to find out what she's really all about.
Yeah.
And the story of him tracking down this girl for her.
Right. And also a little bit Michael Caine, because she works for some wealthy Arabs. She does some hooking or sex work or whatever for some wealthy Arabs. And Caine is constantly trying to find out like what she knows about this guy, and she at one point sets up a ridiculous series of photographs of her and the Arab having just cups of tea, like dainty cups of tea, while she's dressed in this ridiculous bondage leather outfit.
Yeah, she doesn't the outfits in this movie are really, really ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think in those pictures she's just wearing like this like really nice red dress.
I think, yeah, I mean, I remember it as sort of this kind of leather thing. Maybe not.
Oh, maybe it's like a red leather dress then. But it's definitely not. Like, I know there's the scene later where she's tied down, that she's wearing that completely ridiculous leather outfit.
Yeah.
That's like just nothing but straps.
Right.
What'd you get?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Yeah, nothing.
What do you mean, nothing?
I mean nothing, Denny. The opposite to something. I drink tea.
She's lying.
Well, why would she lie?
I don't know. You find out.
How am I going to find out?
Well, take a picture. Climb a drainpipe. Find out.
I've got a picture.
You're trying to be funny, George.
I told you, Denny, she drinks tea.
You are funny, Georgie.
Yeah, I suppose I am, yeah.
Get something better.
Well, how do you mean better?
I mean dirty, nasty, slimy, kinky. I don't want to know anything about tea.
You've also got the idea that he, because he's low rent and because he's a guy, can go, you know, underground and go through this sort of seedy porn shops and seedy sex theatres and all this sort of stuff to possibly find this girl who's maybe been lost amongst the shuffle of sort of sex workers. Whereas she is now, stepped up a couple of notches and is not legit, but, you know, can't exactly go into, a grubby pornographic video store and rough.
Well, I mean,
she
also has to worry about the fact that she's going to search within the realm of the people she got away from.
Right, exactly. Yes, yeah. And that's where Anderson comes into play, because he suddenly realizes that she's sniffing about, and therefore sort of comes back because he was her pimp. And you get the idea that she ran away from him to this slightly better life, out of the frying pan into the fire, as it turns out.
But as far as like the movie is concerned, I mean, it's a good film. I rather enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite bits are, I find that the Brighton ending, because it ends in Brighton, which is, funny enough, Brighton where my mum lives and where I've been several times, and Brighton still looks exactly like that, by the way. That pier is still there and everything.
Nice.
Where he runs along and stuff. It's the Brighton ending is a very, it's a big emotional climax to the movie, because you realize that Bob Hoskins' character felt a ton more for Kathy Tyson than is necessarily hinted at beforehand. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And,
and the fact that he finds out that she doesn't reciprocate, so to speak.
Right, she doesn't reciprocate for a very specific reason.
Well, yeah.
Which angers and upsets and freaks out his tiny little British hood mind. It's fair to say.
It's one of the... Because it took me a second, and like it's sort of like when that scene, when the freakout scene ends... It's sort of revealed why he freaked out, but during the freak out you have no idea, because it comes on like a hurricane and you don't know why it's happening,
right?
You know, and it, I mean, I guess if you're more intuitive to that sort of thing than I am, then maybe you knew, but I didn't know. And obviously when the big reveal is sort of done and you realize that you know, that that George knew, you know, because they kind of play out that a lot, that he's good at solving mysteries, and he's good at seeing the big picture before other people do.
Yeah.
You know?
And so what was your favorite scenes, overall feeling on the film, moments that you liked, things like that?
Well, I mean...
And did and does the Phil Collins music annoy you as much as it annoys me?
Well, I felt the Phil Collins music was so inappropriate. You know, I mean, you've got this guy who's traveling around trying to find an underage girl for Simone, and they're playing In Too Deep.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah. In fact, there's a big montage set to In Too Deep.
In Too Deep, yeah. That's the scene I'm talking about. He's like walking around the streets and, you know, going through these seedy clubs, and it's like, it's In Too Deep. It's like, what the fuck? Why Phil Collins? Like, why did that make any sense at all? But yeah, it's just such a ridiculous use of a ridiculous song.
Yeah, well, they wanted to, you know, at that time, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, Phil Collins was quite a catch in the UK financial wise. Like, he was up there with your Bowie and your Jagger and your Clapton and people like that. These people who sort of went into the 80s and everything that they had done in the 70s that was any good at all, they urinated and shat all over by producing some of the worst middle of the road, you know, mullet head rock music you've ever heard. And they all did it. They all,
there's a couple of really
culpable.
Great lines in the film. One of the best lines, I think, comes from Michael Caine, big surprise. But there's a line where he asks George, he goes, "You didn't really like me, you know, you didn't like me much, did you, George?" He goes, "It's all right. Everyone hates me once in a while."
Yeah.
And I just thought that line was so great. Like, the way he delivered it was just so well done. I really love that line.
I like the way that Michael Caine seems to hang out at this kind of go-go club. This kind of slightly burlesque.
That's his way of well, you know, as you said before, going legit. You know, it's like that instead of doing like the dirty stuff, you know, he's now, you know, running a club.
Right. It's all, I mean, it's the idea to me is all the sex stuff in the movie. And by the way, there's not a lot of actual sort of physical sex portrayed in the film. It's all the
not really any at all. Yeah.
Right, exactly. It's just it's the idea of this utter filth going on behind closed doors. What's interesting is that the clients are the businessmen, the judges, the office workers, the suited, you know, it's the middle classes and the upper classes that are frequenting you know, this utter filthy fucking degrading stuff. But I thought you would kind of get a kick out of this because of all the, you know, sick filth.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. I love the fact that the entire movie is about, I mean, it's essentially about the sex industry, but not really.
Right.
You know, like it's this is a story of, I mean, I guess you could call it unrequited love, you know.
It's got a noir-ish element
within the sex industry.
Sure. I mean, it's unrequited love within the sex industry, the Mona Lisa. No, it's got, I think, in its making, a very noir route. It's got like a very film noir route, because he's one step away from being a, you know, a downtrodden gumshoe. And, you know, she's got one step away from being a femme fatale type thing. In fact, what's interesting about the two movies we're covering is they sort of mirror the two Mitchum movies we covered. Sort of. In the sense that Friends of Eddie Coyle is very much like the kind of bleak 70s gangster movie that Long Good Friday is. And Farewell, My Lovely is sort of the neon-drenched, slightly seedy, you know, storyline of a common girl made good type thing, you know, mixed up in whatever. And as is Mona Lisa, they kind of mirror each other. And I did that unintentionally, but now I've realized I'm...
Well, now you just have to edit that out to make it, you know, to make it look like you did it intentionally.
Or I could just proclaim right now that I'm something of a genius.
I'm so smart that I don't even realize when I'm doing
I'm
something
so
genius.
I'm so smart that I've done the same show twice.
Actually, a lot. The thing I think one of my favorite things about this movie is because this movie's really very dialogue driven. It's very story driven. There's only really one action scene, and that's at the end. And even at that, it's not really an action scene. It's, you know, it's a 3-second chase scene. But there's really I really think. Because, I mean, maybe because he's supposed to be the comic relief, but the conversations between Thomas and George are great. There's some of the best dialogue in the film.
Yeah.
There's a great conversation that they have right after Simone buys George some new clothes. And he goes in to see Thomas. And, you know, Thomas is like, what the hell are you wearing? He's like, I thought it was time I looked like other people. And he goes, you'll never look like other people. And he goes, fuck, is that true?
Yeah, exactly. That's a great quote.
What do you reckon?
What happened to the spaghetti?
Went like hotcakes.
What are you going to do with it?
I'm working in that.
You're mad.
You think so?
Come.
Christ. What's happened to you, George?
I'm growing up, Thomas. Trying to look like other people.
You'll never look like other people, George.
Fuck, is that true? Well, she don't think so.
Aye, what's she up to?
She's not up to anything. She's a friend of mine.
She's got to be up to something, George. What do you think this lot costs?
Well, she's a woman of substance. She's a lady.
Oh, I thought you said she was a tart. Tall, thin, black tart.
Well, maybe. But she's still a fucking lady.
And the subplot storyline about him and his daughter is really sweet.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's something I'd completely left out. Yes, that is very, very cool.
Yeah, because it's almost unexpected, but it's there just enough to remind you that even though George feels like he's got nothing in his life, that he's at least has something because his daughter is interested in knowing him.
Yeah, and I mean, he's got, let's be fair, something of an extraordinarily shitty ex-wife. But,
well, yeah. because the movie opens with him trying to visit his daughter after he gets out of prison.
Yeah.
You know, and essentially, like, she I don't even think she really even knows. Like she, it's, oh, yeah, it's actually explained that she doesn't know why he was gone.
Right.
Like, the mother never told her he was in prison. And so he never told her either. He's like, look, you know, one day when you're older, I'll explain it to you. But
he's kind of the good guy in the wrong place. Like, you kind of feel George is where he is simply because of where he grew up. You don't feel like he necessarily wants to hurt people. Although, you know, he does in defending Simone and stuff. He is, you know, he is a bruiser. But one gets the idea that growing up, you know, on the streets, as it were, you kind of develop that thick skin anyway.
Yeah.
In fact, there's that scene where he had to have very thick skin because Kathy Tyson attacks him with a cat and nine tails for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, she whacks him at least like 15 times.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how Hoskins did that. I mean, you know, maybe they padded out his jacket, but she, you know, lets him have it.
But it's not like she's just hitting his shoulder, though. She's, like, doing it upside the side of his head.
Yes.
And he is crying at the end of that, at the end of that scene. So it kind of makes you wonder if those tears are a little real.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a full blown bull whip, but it's,
no.
You know,
but
it's
she's hitting him. I mean, it is a leather cat of nine tails, sure. And those things do hurt.
And it was all over a misunderstanding.
I would assume they hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. Mo, kindly tell us, please. How would you know? So. Yeah, I mean, it's gritty, gruesome, but also fascinating and, I think, fantastically watchable with a real, like you say, a real emotional core to it, a real heart to it. I mean, it even has, like, a happy ending with him, Thomas, and the daughter kind of all happy together, you know?
And you know what? I wanted to mention that because the ending in this, the happy ending, you know, like Hollywood is notorious,
yes,
for really shitty tacked on happy endings.
Right.
You know, and this didn't feel fake at all, didn't feel tacked on. Okay. Like it really felt like a legitimate, like, happy ending. Like, I really felt good for the characters that they were finally in a good place.
Well, I think that the difference between the two is that you actually see Harold Shand in The Long Good Friday, like, either do some legitimately horrible stuff or, yeah, command people to do some legitimately horrible stuff. But yeah, everything George does, and so therefore the ending he gets is sort of perfect.
Yeah.
Whereas George, throughout the whole movie, is really only trying to do for everyone else kind of what they ask of him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
a lot of situations where he's trying to help people who aren't asking for it.
Right. And he's, you know, trying to help people who, you know, because he, at one point, he thinks a certain girl is the girl that Kathy Tyson's looking for, and it isn't. But he still tries to kind of give her money and give her food and try and get her out of the situation and all the rest of it. And he earns his happy ending, I think. Him and Thomas earn their happy ending. You know what I
mean? Unlike John Travolta, who did not deserve his happy ending. Yeah, Travolta joke.
Yeah.
Fist in the air.
Fucking A. So, dude, did you have any, like, comparisons with the other movie you watched? Were you happy to have seen both movies?
Actually, this was probably one of the best days of movie watching I've had in a while. I mean, what with just recording a No Budget Nightmares and...
Right.
I mean, but that was great, though. I mean, we did Suburban Sasquatch, which was which was really good. Like, I hate to admit how good it was, but it was really good.
But the polar opposite, you know, of these...
Enjoyably bad,
sure,
I'll say.
But the polar opposite of these searing British dramas with...
But yeah, and then the next day, you know,
I watched
Suburban Commando, then the next... not Commando, Suburban Sasquatch, and then the next day. Yeah.
Yes. Although, what would happen if Suburban Commando and Suburban Sasquatch joined forces?
They already did. I mean, Hulk Hogan's already a Sasquatch as it is.
So, yeah, so you like both movies, you give them...
I really did.
And your Anglophile side aside, what sort of... how would you sell these, explain these, and urge other Americans to look these up?
I think I would just say, look, you know, put aside, you know, your obnoxious American habit of hating anybody with an accent and watch these, you know, I mean, yeah, just to sit down, if you know, like, one of them's a really great crime drama, one of them's a really, you know, haunting display of emotion, you know, sit down, watch them.
And they're both on Netflix right now,
and they're,
right?
Both on Netflix,
both streaming live on Netflix at the moment, or available from the Criterion Collection. I've wanted to do a double bill of these two movies since I started the podcast. I can't put these films over more. To me, they are in my top 25 movies. Like, you know, it's hard for me to say, sort of, because I love all the genres, so it's hard for me to say that they would be in the top 25.
You and me kind of have that thing going where we kind of watch everything.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of hard to... It's really hard... to watch, you know, to make a list of what your favorite or the best movies are. Like, the other day I was out at a bar, and somebody had asked me to what my top five movies were. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, like yeah, Seven Samurai is always my number one film. It's been my number one film since 1997. It's not really going anywhere because I haven't seen anything better than it.
Right.
But I can't tell you what my two through five is. It depends on what my mood is. I mean, if I just spent a month watching, you know, teen sex romps, I'm gonna say like Midnight Madness and Joysticks, you know,
or if
I spent my entire time watching, you know, German existentialism, I'm gonna say something else.
Right, exactly. And you know, I would put them in my top 10 crime movies of all time. I mean,
sure,
they stand side by side with anything that, you know, Scorsese or Tarantino or, you know, Eastwood or any of those people have done, for my money. And, you know, it's not surprising after these couple of movies that Hoskins has, because you kind of think of his American career as being Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But when you start to look down his IMDb page, you suddenly realize, like, he's worked with, you know, Oliver Stone, and he's worked with Steven Spielberg. He's in Brazil, famously with Terry Gilliam, you know, and he's cropped up in a lot of these movies during the 80s and the early 90s, and had a fairly successful career of it up until, you know, as you say, a few missteps. But that is what it's going to be, isn't it? Some people just have to get money, you know, have to get work where they can get work.
Exactly.
But, no, thank you for joining us in the diner today, Mo, for discussing those two movies. I've really wanted to kind of get them off my chest, as it were, because I really want to put them out there, along with other Michael Caine stuff like Ipcris File and the original Get Carter and Zulu and films like this.
Well, that's what you have to do next. I mean, you did the ultimate Bond, you know, and covered all the James Bond movies. Yeah. Now you need to do the ultimate Caine and cover all the Michael Caine movies.
You got to cover all the Michael Caine stuff.
It'll only take you 3 years.
Right, exactly.
But you can do it.
But I was just sort of saying more that these two movies sit alongside those other ones. And
sure,
I would urge people not to just watch these two British movies and be like, oh, okay, but to actually then, you know, look much further afield and find other stuff that Hoskins has done and that Caine has done, especially. Hoskins had a sort of resurgence in these kind of movies with 24/7 in 1997, which was done by Shane Meadows, who's a kind of working-class filmmaker who's come out of England in the last 15 years and has done some incredible work. And he's in the first couple of those, so check them out as well. But thank you ever so much for joining us in the diner today, Mo. And enjoy your gigs tonight and everything, sir.
Yeah, I'm going to go rock the house.
Go rock the house, sir, with your drum kit and your ukulele.
No ukulele tonight.
Oh, there's always ukulele, but just in your head and in your heart.
It's very true.
All right, man. Well, look, thanks ever so much for doing this.
And namaste.
Namaste, sir. Goose rubber.
Goose rubber.
All right, dude. Take it easy.
Awesome, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, man, I've named you. You're so light and lady with a mystic smile. Easy only because you're lonely, man, I've named you. For the Mona Lisa, strangers in your smile. Do you smile about the love of Mona Lisa? Or is this the way you hide a broken strawberry tart and many dreams? Have you left on your doorstep? Lonely men have blamed you for the Mona Lisa strangers in your smile. Do you smile at the love of Mona Lisa? Or is this the way you hide a broken strawberry tart? Many dreams have been left on your doorstep, and they just lie there, and they die there. Well, are you warm, are you real, Mona Lisa? Or just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art? Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa.
All the time I was searching with nowhere to run to. tattoo. It started me thinking, wondering what I could make of my life, and who'd be waiting, asking all kinds of questions to myself, but never finding any answers, crying at the top of my voice, and no one's listening. All this time I still remember everything you said. There's so much that you promised. Well, how could I ever forget? Listen, you know I love you, but I just can't take this. You know I love you, but I'm playing for keeps. Although I need you, I'm not gonna make this. You know I want you, but I'm in too deep. So listen, listen to me, oh, you must believe me. I can feel your eyes go through me, but I don't know why. I know that you're going, but I can't believe it's the way you're leaving. It's like we never knew each other at all. Well, maybe my fault, darling. I gave you too many reasons for being alone, when I didn't want to. I thought you'd always be there for me, yeah. Well, I almost believed ya. All this time I still remember everything you said. You said so much. But I just can't take this. You know I love you, but I'm playing for keeps. Oh no, I need you, darling. I'm just not gonna make it. You know I want you, but I'm in too deep. Oh, you know I love you, but I just can't take this. You know I love you, but I'm playing for keeps. Oh no, I need you. I'm not gonna make this. You know I want you, but I'm in too deep. To spend my life just caring about somebody else. Oh yeah, you know I love you, but I just can't take this, darling. You know I love you, but I'm playing for keeps. Although I need you, I am not gonna make this. You know I want you, but I'm in too deep. Too deep, darling.
Hello, I'm Mugumbo, and I am a potaholic. I have been known to consume 4 or 5 of these underground commentaries a day, salivating for the next episodes. I have tweeted the creators of these shows and offered sexual favors for validation and conversation. I put these hosts high on a pedestal, but for some reason, I can never climax until I listen to the Traumatic Cinematic Show. What is the difference, you ask? The Traumatic Cinematic Show has my own self-defecating voice on it. Nothing gets me off faster than thinking about myself. So when you are sitting around nude, pleasuring yourself to the voices of strangers, check out TraumaticCinematic.com, because we'll give you a reach around. You can also find us on TraumaticCinematic.podomatic.com.
I'm on the internet!
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is D.
And this is CJ.
We are two of the three black geeks. The other black geek is in Japan right now. That just showed you how geeky we are. We can do it across the globe.
Yes.
So, for anybody that want to hear just straight up
anime, news, video games, black movies,
yeah,
white movies, every
white movies,
every movie,
all that, all that stuff, because of course everybody's gonna say, hey, won't you guys do Meteor Man? Hey, won't you guys do that one movie that I really, really effing hate?
How about you guys do Steel?
Yeah, because a black person was in that. Yeah, you come to us for that. So, us, me, CJ, and our boy DJ Sue across the water, we are the three black geeks. So,
coming to your podcast week. I know, you know that. That's just real right there. Get us on. You can hear us on Podomatic. You can also go to our website on GenXCast.com. And
if you're really feeling randy, you can go to our YouTube page, www.youtube.com/3blackgeeks, and you can watch our videos of everything, whether it be DJ Chu's crazy adventures in Japan or some of our adventures playing video games or just random odds
and
ends.
And if you really want to get off to us and jack off, just go to our Facebook page. Look it up, 3 Black Geeks, it's right there.
Can't miss it.
Enjoy.
Hello there, patrons of the After Movie Diner. Chris here from Wafoo. What's Wafoo? Well, I'm glad you asked. It's a film blog that I think you will enjoy rather a lot. It's full of reviews, both in video form and in the form of the written word, articles, DVD and Blu-ray news, and various other little pieces of tat. Plus our podcast, which has just debuted, the Top Quality Videotapes podcast. So jump on board now, while we're still just a fledgling young podcast, so in a year's time, when we're kind of a big deal, you can brag and say you were there from the start. Come along to wafu1.wordpress.com. That's WAFU1.wordpress.com.